they've talked to you about the Flood Protection Authority's lawsuit. A lot of what both Jones Swanson's firm and my firm do is do what's called legacy litigation. And legacy litigation, the term legacy, was, there was two sides of the coin of how people refer to that. One was that the oil companies said that these properties were handed down from landowner to their kids, their grandkids, so forth. And so that legacy, the by the time the grandkids or great-grandkids got the property and their royalty payments were lower, they filed suit against the oil company for land contamination. The Supreme Court, however, saw it a different way, and they said that the legacy actually comes from the oil company's bad practices, the legacy they left and their bad practices that harm the land. So those are both sides of the issue, and I'll try and give you both sides because it's important to know whether you're defending these cases or on the plaintiff's side, what the issues are and how these things come up. What you see on the screen is a picture of what we call a salt scar. And this is a case, I've changed the names a bit, just so, even though the case was tried, I changed the name just so we'll stay friendly with everybody. So it was in Catahoula Parish, that's an area where between Natchez and Alexandria, thereabouts. And this is what happens when brine, which is a byproduct of oil field drilling, you know, things come out of the ground, you poke a hole in it, there's oil, there's gas, and there's this brine that you can't really do anything with. You either truck it off, inject it back down in the injection well below the water zone, or you just put it in a pit. Unfortunately, for many years, they put these things in a pit, and you get, this is what it leaves. And you may say, well, that looks nice. It looks like Destin or something. But it's stuff will never grow there, and we'll get to that more later. Brine
salted
is far more saltier than the ocean. So it's a particular problem, especially in Louisiana, because we were the last state to outlaw pits. We didn't do it until the late 70s, even get started with it. Many states had done it, outlawed much earlier than that. Let's just talk about, this is kind of a garden variety legacy case. And so it was fairly simple. It was tried in a couple of weeks. So we'll go through it. The property, as I said, in Catahoula Parish, 250 acres of farmland, used as farmland, cotton, beans, corn. And this is where it is. This is going to kind of be are you talking after me or not? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I can take my time since we'll have a lot of questions. Mid-level oil company is the company that was one of the companies that were sued. We sued, you saw the initial slide had Sam Spears, and what you find in a lot of these cases is that in the early days, the big oil companies, the Shell, the Exxons, they picked the low-hanging fruit. And when they got rid of that, they started handling it to mid-level operators. And then when they got through, they handled it to fly-by-night operators. So the call him Jim Jones or Sam Spears, whatever, the fly-by-night guy, he's nowhere to be found. And if he does, he doesn't have anything at all. And so we run into those problems. But mid-level oil company had it during the time it was making most of the, producing a lot of the oil and gas, and they leased it in 1960. And they always call these things field, different names of fields, and it's Bodner's Break Field. So a typical oil and gas mineral lease, I'd say typical, there's really not one, you see this is what's called a bath farm. Which is Bath was the printer. That's why they call them Bath Farm. But anyway, most of the stuff's already written, and the landman goes and knocks on the door, and he gets the person to sign it, tells him he's going to give him, whatever for the royalty. This is signed in June 1960. There's the close-up of the field. And here's what the property looked like in 1959. And in all these cases, aerial photos are our best friend because they tell us when the property was first developed, where they put the pits, where we can even tell, and you'll see in a second, which way the wind was blowing and, you know, whether it was all pooled on it. But in any event, the aerial photographs tell us what the damage was and when was it done, because in many cases you have a timeline that stretches for literally 60, 70 years, and you have to find out, well, which one of these guys really started the problem, or how many of them participated in the problem. And you can do that by looking at these aerial photographs and seeing, first, this is what it looks like today. This is what it looked like in 59. What I was saying is, you can look at those aerial photographs and start seeing where the pits are, when they started developing. It's almost like a, you know, a very long time-lapse photograph. Luckily, the USDA and forestry were doing flyovers of this area of the country back in the late 40s and 50s. And so they provide, through present time, but they provided a very important piece of evidence when you go back on these cases that you're looking at evidence, literally, that was, in some instances, 80 years ago or so. So, as I told you, here's what it looks like today. At the time of trial, this is what it looked like. Sadly, and this trial was probably about 3 years ago, sadly, it still looks like that. We'll get to, even though we won, we'll get to why that's the case. So, more pictures, and this is just to show you, this stuff is like a fine salt dust kind of material. And you can see that, you know, even, there's really nothing that, nothing grows. I mean, here you can see where they tried to maybe make something grow, put a little plot, and, you know, they try with the most, Bermuda grass is the most thing that they'll try and see if it grows. Nothing grows. And this is not the original pit, we'll get to later, but this is due to the fact that this stuff seeps and migrates and goes out. So what may have started with a 100 by 200 pit now is the size of a 200 feet, 100 by 200 feet pit. Migrates out, and it's now as big as a football field. So, and that's just, like my law partner says, the tip of the iceberg, because when it seeps and goes down, then it goes down laterally and deeper, and then you may have as many as, you know, hundreds of acres of water below this, groundwater, that becomes affected over time. So, how did it get this way? I went through a little bit, mid-level operated lease, produced lots of oil and gas, it assigned its interest to another company, and then also that company assigned its interest to Three Rivers. You're always looking at different operators and what they did. Three Rivers assigned it to Sam Spear Jr. Spears abandoned the lease, abandoned pretty much life. In fact, we found him, I think, in Mississippi, and was not, he was, let's just call it retired. The problem you have is, in this case, the wells, all those operators just kept leaving the stuff. And so the wells were not properly plugged and abandoned, because Sam Spears was the last guy on the list. And the state has what's known as an orphan well program. And maybe some of you in here can tell us how many orphan wells the state of Louisiana is tracking right now, but the number is crazy. There's a big long spreadsheet. I was asked one time to actually go find it, and I did, and they prioritize them, and even the ones that were the worst priorities, like near school and the water tower, you know, weren't being properly plugged and abandoned. So as a state, we're behind in many things, and this is one of them. So this is just one little part we often find is part and parcel with the legacy that the oil company leave behind. So the well produced 1.3 million barrels of brine during mid-levels operations, 60 to 1973. It was producing over 90% brine by no later than 1965. In South Louisiana especially, or Louisiana, this area of the country, it's not uncommon for wells and later in their lives to produce 90% to 95% brine, and all companies will continue to operate those wells knowing that, you know, 10% or 5% is better than nothing, better than a dry hole, but they got to do something with that brine, and it's a lot. It's a lot of stuff. There's another well drilled. It was a dry hole, and what companies do and what it's legal to do and is a best practice, whether you can argue whether it's really a best practice or not, is to convert a dry hole into a saltwater disposal well. And so they'll take that well that they didn't get all out of and then re-inject the brine instead of having to truck it off, which is expensive. I said, well, let's just keep it local. We'll put it back where hopefully it came from, below the water supply, and everything is going to be good. And that works well if the well was drilled well, didn't have well and drilled properly. It did not have holes that where the salt water could leak into the groundwater, didn't have gaps, was properly cemented, all the things that need to happen so that you'd have a really good well that you can call a proper disposal well. In any event, they converted it to a saltwater disposal well in 1966. There's a third well drilled in 61, 665,000 barrels of brine. And this well was a little bit better on the all versus brine side, 65%. And so that means, you know, old math, 35% was all. So during the operations, all those wells produced about 2 million barrels of brine. That's a lot of brine. And there's ways to calculate this because they have to report this to the state. One thing is great about when you're doing these cases, and what's really incredible is what we find in the documents. These all companies report everything very nicely, and they send it to the state. They also report when they really screw up, and they write it down. And the culture was at the time, and you'll see it maybe in some of these documents, in this case, I can't remember, but we'll see. They're almost, the culture was, you know, we're going to write down that we screwed up here and we caused a big problem. And, you know, it's not a big deal because nobody's going to come get us. We're not going to get in trouble about it. You know, it's just an economic thing we're documenting here. Because, you know, we missed out maybe on some oil. And so what if we, you know, had this problem that caused the pollution? It didn't do any harm. At the time, they didn't think it did any harm. But you'll see, they should have known better. So, mid-level did not use that injection well it had there. Instead of using it as it was intended to be used, they kept doing a couple things. They either dumped the brine into unlined pits, which seeped into soil and groundwater, or they allowed the brine to overflow onto the surface of the property. Or they discharge the brine in nearby waterways. And so when we look at these aerial photographs sometimes, we'll see where we have this dead vegetation, and we'll see that it kind of continues. There's even more of it that goes down a little ditch into a canal. And so you get where, because of brine being a fluid, it just goes to the lowest points. Either it seeps into the ground in the groundwater, or it just goes all over the property and damages the property for a long period of time. Now, they didn't, as I said, quit using the unlined pits after it installed the injection well. They continued to store the brine in the pits, and the brine continued to seep from the unlined pits into the salt and the groundwater. The main pit was 150 feet by 175 feet and at least 4 foot deep. It had an approximate storage volume of 18,000 barrels of brine. Now you remember, you had 18,000 barrels of brine as a storage area, and you remember the numbers I went through, how much brine it was producing. So there wasn't any evidence of anybody trucking anything off. So that stuff just seeped and leaked into the ground, into the groundwater. So here's what the main pit looked like. And in this case, you can see you actually see some crude, the winds blowing out of the north, northwest, and pulling that all in the south, southeast corner. And that's what it looked like in 1972. So made a mess, and it didn't do anything to clean it up. And that's the case in about every one of our hundreds of cases that our firms and other firms do. The companies walk away from it. And then when it comes time to clean up, they first say, well, it wasn't us. If it was us, we didn't know that, well, one, you're too late, the suit is too late. Prescription three, if it was us and your own time, it really didn't do any damage because nobody's using the groundwater right now. You know, we may have ruined the groundwater, but nobody's using it for, there's no houses out here, it's just farmland. So, you know, you can truck some water in to water your crops or get it from a nearby river or something like that. But don't worry about the groundwater because, you know, nobody's using it as in a household or anything, so we don't need to fix it. Or they will say, you really can't prove it was our brine that contaminated the salt water aquifer. In fact, we can go back to, you know, thousands of years where there was an ancient river that ran through here, and it was known to have salt in it. They will even use, if you know this area of the state, has lakes that are called, there's a lake called Saline Lake, Saline Bayou, a few things like that. Now granted, all those bodies of water are completely fresh, have white perch in them. But they will say, well, there must be evidence of, you know, the reason why they call those things that is because it was naturally salty in that area. So you really can't prove that it was us. Luckily, we prevail most of the time on that, but that's the kind of arguments you're faced with. We generally have the theme, clean up your own mess. Robert Fulghum, who was a minister, wrote this book, and he had some basic advice, some basic rules that could guide anyone, even a kindergartner, to lead a happy life, and one of those is clean up your own mess. Interestingly, this is from a BP. You're on their property, you know, follow the rules. So everyone knew it was wrong. We'll get to that in a second. This is the, what's really, really great is the oil companies spend a lot of money on research. And in fact, you watch, Masters golf tournament, you see them in white lab coats, like curing cancer or something. I think they spend actually more money on those commercials than they do on curing cancer. But they have what's called the American Petroleum Institute. And the American Petroleum Institute, API, is based in D.C. And they get the best and the brightest from the oil companies to write about what they can do better. And they try. I'll give them that. The guys that write this stuff are well-intentioned. When it gets down to the guys that have to spend the money to do the right stuff, it's a little different story sometimes. So this is written in Pampa, Texas in 1932. It's called a Division of Production, Division Waste. Now, 1932, you can imagine, we didn't have email, we didn't have fax machines, and the oil companies will say, well, this was out of Pampa, Texas, it must have not have got, it wasn't widely distributed. And these people were still going to API in D.C. and having these caucuses. They act like we were back in the Stone Age. They use the defense, well, this didn't get disseminated. That generally fails, too, as you'll see in a second. So the API says we're only kidding ourselves when we think that we can dispose of salt water by solar evaporation from earthen ponds. What we have attributed to evaporation was due to seepage. They said we had this pond, and we thought of just going up, and God was taken away, and everything was going to be okay, but it wasn't. It was seeping. And he says eventually such seepage may either follow an impervious stratum to the surface, where it may affect vegetation or may find its way to freshwater sources, either surface or subsurface in such quantities as to be objectionable. Kind of a nice way of saying people are going to get pissed. And they did. And they do. When you ruin somebody's water supply and they're a farmer, you can't fix it. You just can't fix it. Or if you ruin their acreage, you can't get that back. And every farmable acre is very important to a farmer.
To the niche.
So this is, we take corporate depositions, whether it's federal court 36 or state court 1442, depositions of the corporate representative, change the name here. And so we asked him, you're aware that the use of unlined pits is a hazard for the storage of brine? Yes. And the reason is because unlined pits seep and leak and the brine penetrates in the surrounding soil and groundwater, correct? Answer, yes. And that's been known in the industry in Louisiana for many, many years. Answer, quite a few, yeah. In any event, the hazards associated with unlined pits have been well known and experienced all field operators for many years. Correct? Correct. Now, remember, this guy is a mid-level owner of an oil company. And so, you know, they're kind of stuck. They can't claim ignorance and also be the big oil guy on the block. And so he nicely admits to it. And the main hazard is that they create a salt contamination in the surrounding soil and groundwater. Answer, yes. So the head of the oil company knows it. Their own petroleum engineer says it's wrong. His name is Charles Moffitt. And so I asked him, are you aware that mid-level testified that it's aware that the use of unlined pits is a hazard, so forth? Yes, he showed me that. I asked him, you agree with that? He says, yes. Can't only disagree with the guy's painting, but sometimes that happens. So, and I asked him, are you aware that these facts were known by the industry for many years? Yeah. So despite this, rather than installing a proper disposal system in the beginning, it dumped hundreds of thousands of barrels of brine into the pits on the property. Now this happens, this is one case, but we can tell you 1,000 stories like this all over the state where this same thing occurs. So, importantly, in 1965, they knew that the pit was leaking. They get a letter. It's the letter from, I changed the name, so it's the mid-level guy to Mr. O.B. Mobley in July 1965. We've inspected the surface location of a number two Boatner, which is the dry hole north of Discovery Well, and find that it is covered by approximately 4 inches of salt water. As you know, we have received a call, because this is a complaint he had gotten to respond to, from the Tensaw Basin Levee Board advising that they will proceed with a cease and desist order on our producing wells unless we immediately take steps to correct the salt water situation in this field. The last thing an oil company guy wants to hear is that he's going to have to cease and desist from the stuff that's making his money. So he's now, and this is an emergency to him, the money, we're going to shut down the oil if you don't do something about this. So what'd they do? They continue to use the unlined pits, even though they knew better. And so now, in 1969, they get a letter from the Department of Conservation. And this is a common deal. So the documents say a lot, either from the state or from the Tensaw Levee Board or from a neighbor or whatever. It says, representatives of the Inspection Enforcement Division surveyed the production facilities in the above-mentioned field and noted the following items which are not in line with the regulations set forth in Statewide Order 29B. Statewide Order 29B is the, I won't call it commandment, that's too strong of a word, it's the guidance for all companies on what they have to do with when they have an oil operation, everything from how a well gets, drilled to how they're supposed to leave it when they're through. So they say there's no retaining wall around the stock tanks to prevent spillage. that occurs in everyday operations resulting in pollution. Our agent reports the lease is equipped with a saltwater disposal pit and a disposal well. And at the time of this injection, he reports that the fluid level in said pit was above ground level and seepage was occurring through the surrounding levee. Attached here too is a copy of his color photograph. We usually don't get color photographs in these cases because they're too old. And we don't get them. We don't get a state inspector who on his own documents it. For that to happen, it's got to be really bad. In fact, this is the only case where I had a state inspector take a photograph of a escaping brine. It must have, I don't know if he stayed on the job long or where he got it from, but God bless him, he took a photograph of it. Not a good photograph, but anyway, it looks bad on my screen, and you can come look at it later, but he took a photograph of it, thank God. So we have contaminated property in just 6 years of mid-levels operations. Here's the 1966 aerial photo. Again, we got the northeast wind pulling the oil in the south, excuse me, northwest wind pulling in the southeast corner. General Honore's going to get mad at me here in a second if I get a compass setting wrong. 1972 aerial photo. So what did they say after looking at the contamination? You know, you always, whether it's a car accident or anything else, you say, you know, did my client do anything to contribute to this? In this case, you ask, you know, do you know of anything else that could cause this besides brine, produce brine? He gave a truthful answer. No, I don't. That's what it does. You know, it's what's really not funny, but it's sad. The industry views this as, yeah, I did it. I mean, but we all did it. So they use the "we all did it" excuse, and everybody was doing it. And, you know, it's just salt water is the other thing you hear. So it's really hard sometimes even for a jury to you know, they want, the defense calls it salt water, you know, and they'll say that, you know, you can pull a bottle of water and, you know, they'll find some sodium in it and say, you know, it's just a matter of degree. So you're faced with all those types of hogwash defenses when you try these cases. So in this case, what was undisputed, it was contaminated, that they caused the contamination, and the time frame was important because of the number of operators you're dealing with, that timeline, they were responsible for it because you can pin how much brine they produced and the contamination using the overhead flyover photographs. So in this case, the mineral lease, that bath farm I showed you earlier, it contained no specific restoration clause. Many leases will say to original condition or all damages. Those would be the good ones. Some say we're only responsible for, you know, the trees we cut down to get to our site or something like that. There's lots of cases where the landowner was not terribly sophisticated. The landman took advantage of that, and the leases did not require much restoration at all. In this case, or absent a contract provision, the standard is where the lessee is operated unreasonably or excessively, as in this case, the lessee has the obligation to correct the damage due to the unreasonable or excessive operations. That comes from Marine versus Exxon, a recent case. So we would argue correct the damage means original condition. They say correct the damage means regulatory. Now remember, you've been here, some of you, I guess Friday, you probably heard many times that Louisiana does not have the best reputation in writing laws that protect the earth, the ground, the land, the state, the resources. And so it's all a matter of degree. And so the regulatory says, well, you know, you only have to restore to a level of grow Bermuda grass to 3 feet, you know, down to 3 feet, well, they could have, if nobody's using the groundwater, if it's not usable groundwater being used at the time, you don't have to clean up it either. Well, the restoration is not going to be that big a requirement either. So we'll get to what happened in this case in just a second. But so that's what we're dealing with. And we have experts, we have opposing experts. And for example, our expert says that if you're going to do everything, correct the groundwater, you're going to get that huge salt score and really excavate it all, carry off the dirt, do all what you need to do to make it where it's right before oil and gas operations put a footprint on there. It's going to cost $57 million because you have to, and the biggest cost in this is generally the pumping and treating of the groundwater. And, you know, they do that in Texas all the time. They do that all other places. In Louisiana, they act like, you know, when you cross the border, the technology is, they can't truck it here or something. That's the defense of it anyway. So in all these cases, just like anything, if I spill something, if I clean it up right away, it doesn't cost much time and energy. If you wait decades after you do something of this nature, it costs a lot of money. So the graph of cost and time, the longer you wait, the more it's going to cost. It's just natural. So our expert was Mr. Araby. Their expert was Mr. Lahe. And basically, the differences between the cleanup models was that the defense uses this phrase, monitored natural attenuation. You break it down, it means you watch, and you look, and you do nothing. So that's what we're faced with. You know, you retest, you go back and you keep testing and make sure it's not worse. Well, you know, it's just going to spread. The numbers may not go up. It's just going to stay the same or get worse. So this is Mr. Lahe. My colleague is questioning that, you know, you're not claiming that your proposal will clean up all the oil field contamination on this property. He says, right, my proposal does not propose to remediate 100%. Okay, in fact, you don't claim that your proposal will restore this property to its pre-oil and gas state, correct? He agrees, no, not to its pre-oil and gas state. So, in all these cases, you're faced with, you look at it, why hasn't anyone done anything? You know, you get to these sites and, you know, no one has done the first thing to try and clean it up because people just walk away from it. They say this is the way we do things. Everybody does it. You know, the landowner got his money for his oil and his gas, and you know, he didn't complain at the time. Well, most of the cases, you don't see this effect until years later, or this marked effect, as you saw in the historical photos. But the biggest reason is because it costs money to do it right. When you make this kind of mess, it costs a lot of money to fix it. And interestingly, these people are real upfront that it's not in their interest to do it the right way. I've never had it this easy explained to me before, but I give you, they had this meeting, so I'm proposing the petroleum engineer. He says, I've asked you this before. I apologize. Who else was in the meeting that day? Jay Lahe, that's an environmental expert. Joe, Jim, those are the oil company guys. Some other people. Question, I don't want to talk. I want you to tell me what Mr. Wilson, the lawyer, discussed with you, but tell me the discussions between or among you, Mr. Lahe and Mr. Burton. Answer, we were looking at what was the least expensive way that we could clean up the damaged area. Asking what was the opinion. I wasn't privy to that. They were going to submit the report, and I've not seen it. Question, but the goal was to get the least expensive way to clean it up. Answer, right. Well, they have this stuff. I call it pixie dust, but it's, you know, they put a chemical on a chemical and hope it goes away, lessens the brine or the sodium there, and it takes about forever for it to work, if it works. So it's really not, it's not usable. It doesn't work on the, especially something this big. And what's nice is even the API says you don't use it in pits. You don't use the chemical amendment remediation of gypsum. You put gypsum on it. I call it pixie dust because that's what they actually think it's going to work, and it never does. But they keep selling it, you know. So anyway, at the end, you know, any of these oil companies, the choice is you do it right and you keep the property clean, or you do it cheaply and either make a mess and continue to make a mess by not cleaning it up right. And as you saw, even to the day of trial, they are saying it costs too much to do it right. We're going to do it the least expensive way. That's what we're trying to do. So that's a typical case. In this case, the judge awarded, he kind of had bought the DNR, Department of Natural Resources model for cleanup. At the time this case was tried, one of the first cases had gone before the DNR star chamber that is composed of DNR regulators who say what really needs to be cleaned up for to satisfy regulations. And the thought that DNR had was, we're just going to make you clean it up to plow depth, which is about 3 feet deep. But what happens, especially in this area of the country, where the soils are very have a lot of clay, they have a high water table, that it rains and whatever's down there, the brine's down there 20, 30 feet down, it's just going to bring it right back up to the surface. So even if you cleaned it up to plow depth, one rainy season later, it's going to be right back where it started. So
the same with the school.
It's not a very scientific or logical way of doing things, but that's what DNR put out there. This judge thought that made sense. The proof's in the pudding. The property, property still looks like that today. If you were to Google Earth or fly over it or drive to it, even though they've tried all the things that Mr. Lahey said was going to work, none of it's worked, even though they only are having to clean up to 3 feet. So that's the part of the problem is the culture, and you'll hear more about that, I'm sure, later from General Honore. You may have heard it already before, is that we have protected an industry like no other industry has been protected. We make laws especially for them. They, in fact, in testifying before the legislature last year, I said, why don't you just be honest with everybody and amend Article 2315 and just put at the end, except for oil companies. You know, just get cut to the chase. Instead of having all these rules and amendments to different parts of the law that at the end means they do less or do next to nothing, let's just do what you're trying to do. Just take them out of the equation and let them have their way. So I'll stop now. I think we probably have about 5 minutes left for to ask questions amongst any of us at this time. Thank you.
I think that just to put a cap on this, on our panel and open up to questions, whether it's your garden variety legacy case, like Rock and Tad and I have a lot of experience with, or the SLIFPA case, the themes are the same, that the oil and gas companies have known what their obligations are, they have known when they have been derelict in those obligations, and they also know the consequences of those of not following through on those obligations. And we've had the opportunity to make that record in a number of cases, and we're all looking forward to a positive result in the Fifth Circuit so we can make that record on behalf of the SLIFPA. So with that, we do have a few minutes for questions, if anybody has any. Here, right here in the front.
Two levy questions. One, had your trial judge been a state court judge before she became a federal judge? And two, did she allow oral argument before ruling on the motion?
Yeah, on your first question, she had not been a judge prior to her appointment to the federal court. She had been a litigator for a number of years. She was the city attorney for a few years. And then she got the appointment to the federal bench. We did have oral argument. She actually had oral argument on 2 days, one day just on the motions to dismiss and another day. We had brought an offensive summary judgment motion on Act 544, and she had oral argument on that. I think those were like November 12th and December 10th. And then, of course, her opinion came out on February 13th. So fairly quick and timely order after those arguments. We just think missing some of the finer points.
In the back?
What damages were pled in your petition for the levy board?
You want to do that?
Yeah, I'll take that. So the damages pled were the damages for the increased cost of providing flood protection as a consequence of the loss of the buffer zone, which enables the system, the levees and the flood protection assets, to function to a 100-year standard. There is that includes maintenance, operation, rehab, also construction cost share, and then also specifically in our petition, we did plead for injunctive relief, which would be the restoration component, not of the flood assets, but of the wetlands.
So economic losses for the levy board?
Economic losses for the levy board, yes. Anybody else? Oh, over here.
A quickie. I seem to remember the Fifth Circuit had a case with Coma or Local Oil that kind of created theory in the Fifth Circuit on bulk.
The Comer case? Is that the one you referenced?
Comer traveled a very interesting path through the federal courts. The district court in the Southern District of Mississippi, Comer is a case brought essentially about greenhouse gas emissions and their role was. I don't want to get too deep into it because. Well, anyway, Southern District of Mississippi said this was a political question, not just justiciable. We're going to dismiss it. The Fifth Circuit, in a panel opinion, reversed the Southern District of Mississippi and said no, this needs to go forward. Then there was a vote by the Fifth Circuit to take Comer en banc, which immediately vacated the panel opinion. Before they had the en banc rehearing, I think one of the judges maybe retired. I think they ended up with a tie vote, essentially, which meant nothing. They didn't have a quorum.
No quorum.
Yeah, they lost one.
That's it. So they had taken the vote already to take it en banc, which vacated the district court, vacated the panel opinion, and ended up with nothing in its place, so it just remained reversed.
But a very interesting case, because the panel opinion in finding that there was a duty on behalf of these defendants who had been responsible for these emissions, finding there was a duty to the plaintiffs. So a case that we were familiar with early on, and we're counting on to at least stand for something in terms of how the Fifth Circuit will think about these issues.
Even though technically it doesn't exist
anymore. Right.
Somebody ought to write a little case note on that one day, because I'm still the trivia question of how a case can just go away when you have an en banc and they don't have a quorum. You would think that the three-judge panel ruling would stay. Instead, it just goes poof. I find that it's strange that they didn't have a quorum, and if that's the rule, that's a heck of a way to make a case go away, is just have some people not make it to the en banc for quorum. But anyway, that's a rule I didn't know until recently.
There's an argument it may be a violation of due process, if you think about it, not to have an available appellate body.
Right. Which court do you make that argument in?
Well, that's...
We've got one more question over here, I think it is.
I think this is an example of the pixie dust work that the opinion is doing here. The legacy question is not equal to common limitations.
The contract language, the contract script is 10 years, so there needs to be activity, all the gas activity on the property within 10 years. So that's your, if there's not, then you don't, unless they really, did something strange or you do a contra non voluntas. But the TARC claims, which we do bring in cases where we notice it within a year, sometimes those stick, sometimes they don't. So, we really concentrate on the contractual provisions, hopefully giving us the all damages provision or original condition or something like that.
I would add that the Marine decision gives a pretty some pretty good insight into how courts view what is knowledge sufficient to excite attention in the context of legacy cases. And Rock's right, those the contract claims are generally, that's going to be your fallback. But we do bring the tort claims, and we do fight hard through the prescription issues, and we win them often. More often than I think lawyers who are not practicing in a legacy context would think. I think there was a question over here I didn't want to miss you.
There was a question from Mr. Palermo. Did you guys conduct a norm survey at that site?
Yeah. At that site, norm, we do it some, and it comes up in the testing, the water testing. Generally, norm was not an issue at that site of any significance. It is in some, not in that one, my recollection. If it would have been, you would have seen it in the slideshow.
There we go. Yeah.
Real quick memory check. On the Comer, wasn't there a motion to the Supremes for a supervisory writ, and they didn't grant cert to hear it?
I don't recall. Is that right?
I think there was an attempt to get the Supremes to order the Fifth to do something, and the Supremes denied the cert.
Correct.
So it was like auxiliary pixie dust. The Supremes had a chance to issue an order, and they decided not to.
Noted. Thank you. Anybody else? I think we were till 5:45.
Yeah, our time's up.
Okay. All right.